what is on the other side is normal life. I should say, what is on the other side looks like normal life. There is a desk, of course, with a CompuTalk on it, and a black leather chair behind it. There's a potted plant on the desk, a pen holder set, papers. There's an oriental rug on the floor, and a fireplace without a fire in it. There's a small sofa covered in brown plush, a television set, an end table, a couple of chairs. But all around the walls there are bookcases. They're filled with books. Books and books and books, right out in plain view. No locks, no boxes. No wonder we can't come in here. It's an oasis of the forbidden. I try not to stare. The commander is standing in front of the fireless fireplace, back to it, one elbow on the carved wooden overmantel, other hand in his pocket. It's such a studied pose, something of the country squire, some old come-on from a glossy men's mag. He's probably decided ahead of time that he'd be standing like that when I came in. When I knocked, he probably rushed over to the fireplace and propped himself up. He should have a black patch over one eye, a cravat with horseshoes on it. It's all very well for me to think these things, quick as staccato, a jittering of the brain, an inner jeering, but it's panic. The fact is, I'm terrified. I don't say anything. Close the door behind you, he says, pleasantly enough. I do it and turn back. Hello, he says. It's the old form of greeting. I haven't heard it for a long time, for years. Under the circumstances, it seems out of place, comical even, a flip backward in time, a stunt. I can think of nothing appropriate to say in return. I think I will cry. He must have noticed this, because he looks at me, puzzled, gives a little frown I choose to interpret as concern, though it may merely be irritation. Here, he says, you can sit down. He pulls a chair out for me, sets it in front of his desk. Then he goes around behind the desk and sits down, slowly, and it seems to me, elaborately. What this act tells me is that he hasn't brought me here to touch me in any way against my will. He smiles. The smile is not sinister or predatory. It's merely a smile, a formal kind of smile, friendly but a little distant, as if I'm a kitten in a window, one he's looking at but doesn't intend to buy. I sit up straight on the chair, my hands folded on my lap. I feel as if my feet in their flat red shoes aren't quite touching the floor, but of course they are. You must find this strange, he says. I simply look at him. The understatement of the year was the phrase my mother used. I feel like cotton candy, sugar and air. Squeeze me and I'd turn into a small, sickly, damp wad of weeping pinky red. I guess it is a little strange, he says, as if I've answered. I think I should have a hat on, tied with a bow under my chin. I want, he says. I try not to lean forward. Yes, yes, yes. What then? What does he want? But I won't give it away, this eagerness of mine. It's a bargaining session. Things are about to be exchanged. She who does not hesitate is lost. I'm not giving anything away. Selling only. I would like, he says. This will sound silly, and he does look embarrassed. Sheepish was the word, the way men used to look once. He's old enough to remember how to look that way, and to remember also how appealing women once found it. The young ones don't know those tricks. They've never had to use them. I'd like you to play a game of Scrabble with me, he says. I hold myself absolutely rigid. I keep my face unmoving. So that's what's in the forbidden room. Scrabble! I want to laugh, shriek with laughter, fall off my chair. This was once the game of old women, old men in the summers or in the retirement villas, to be played when there was nothing good on television. Or of adolescence once, long, long ago. My mother had a set, kept at the back of the hall cupboard with the Christmas tree decorations in their cardboard boxes. Once she tried to interest me in it when I was 13 and miserable and at loose ends. Now, of course, it's something different. Now it's forbidden for us. Now it's dangerous. Now it's indecent. Now it's something he can't do with his wife. Now it's desirable. Now he's compromised himself. It's as if he's offered me drugs. All right, I say as if indifferent. I can, in fact, hardly speak. He doesn't say why he wants to play Scrabble with me. I don't ask him. He merely takes a box out from one of the drawers in his desk and opens it up. There are the plasticized wooden counters, I remember, the board divided into squares, the little holders for setting the letters in. He dumps the counters out on the top of his desk and begins to turn them over. After a moment, I join in. "You know how to play?" he says. I nod. We play two games. Larynx, I spell. Valence. Quince. Zygote. I hold the glossy counters with their smooth edges, finger the letters. The feeling is voluptuous. This is freedom. An eye blink of it. Limp, I spell. Gorge. What a luxury. The counters are like candies made of peppermint, cool like that. Humbugs, those were called. I would like to put them into my mouth. They would taste also of lime. The letter C. Crisp. Slightly acid on the tongue. Delicious. I win the first game. I let him win the second. I still haven't discovered what the terms are, what I will be able to ask for in exchange. Finally, he tells me it's time for me to go home. Those are the words he uses. Go home. He means to my room. He asks me if I will be all right, as if the stairway is a dark street. I say yes. We open his study door just a crack and listen for noises in the hall. This is like being out on a date. This is like sneaking into the dorm after hours. This is conspiracy. Thank you, he says, for the game. And then he says, I want you to kiss me. I think about how I could take the back of the toilet apart, the toilet in my own bathroom, on a bath night, quickly and quietly, so Cora outside on the chair would not hear me. I could get the sharp lever out and hide it in my sleeve and smuggle it into the commander's study the next time. Because after a request like that, there's always a next time, whether you say yes or no. I think about how I could approach the commander to kiss him here alone and take off his jacket as if to allow or invite something further, some approach to true love, and put my arms around him and slip the lever out from the sleeve and drive the sharp end into him suddenly between his ribs. I think about the blood coming out of him, hot as soup, sexual, over my hands. In fact, I don't think about anything of the kind. I put it in only afterwards. Maybe I should have thought about that at the time, but I didn't. As I said, this is a reconstruction. All right, I say. I go to him and place my lips closed against his. I smell the shaving lotion, the usual kind, the hint of mothballs, familiar enough to me. But he's like someone I've only just met. He draws away, looks down at me. There's the smile again, the sheepish one. Such candor. Not like that, he says. As if you meant it. He was so sad. That is a reconstruction, too. Night. 24. I go back, along the dimmed hall and up the muffled stairs, stealthily to my room, where I sit in the chair with the lights off and my red dress hooked and buttoned. You can think clearly only with your clothes on. What I need is perspective, the illusion of depth created by a frame, the arrangement of shapes on a flat surface. Perspective is necessary. Otherwise, there are only two dimensions. Otherwise, you live with your face squashed against a wall, everything a huge foreground of details, close-ups, hairs, the weave of the bedsheet, the molecules of the face. Your own skin like a map, a diagram of futility, crisscrossed with tiny roads that lead nowhere. Otherwise, you live in the moment, which is not where I want to be. But that's where I am. There's no escaping it. Time's a trap. I'm caught in it. I must forget about my secret name and all ways back. My name is Ovfred now, and here is where I live. Live in the present. Make the most of it. It's all you've got. Time to take stock. I am 33 years old. I have brown hair. I stand 5'7" without shoes. I have trouble remembering what I used to look like. I have viable ovaries. I have one more chance. But something has changed now, tonight. Circumstances have altered. I can ask for something. Possibly not much, but something. Men are sex machines, said Aunt Lydia, and not much more. They only want one thing. You must learn to manipulate them for your own good. Lead them around by the nose. That is a metaphor. It's nature's way. It's God's device. It's the way things are. Aunt Lydia did not actually say this, but it was implicit in everything she did say. It hovered over her head like the golden mottoes over the saints of the darker ages. Like them, too, she was angular and without flesh. But how to fit the commander into this as he exists in his study with his word games and his desire for what? To be played with? To be gently kissed as if I meant it? I know I need to take it seriously, this desire of his. It could be important. It could be a passport. It could be my downfall. I need to be earnest about it. I need to ponder it. But no matter what I do, sitting here in the dark with the searchlights illuminating the oblong of my window from outside, through the curtains gauzy as a bridal dress, as ectoplasm, one of my hands holding the other, rocking back and forth a little, no matter what I do, there's something hilarious about it. He wanted me to play Scrabble with him and kiss him as if I meant it. This is one of the most bizarre things that's happened to me ever. Context is all. I remember a television program I once saw, a rerun made years before. I must have been 7 or 8, too young to understand it. It was the sort of thing my mother liked to watch, historical, educational. She tried to explain it to me afterwards, to tell me that the things in it had really happened. But to me, it was only a story. I thought someone had made it up. I suppose all children think that about any history before their own. If it's only a story, it becomes less frightening. The program was a documentary about one of those wars. They interviewed people and showed clips from films of the time, black and white, and still photos. I don't remember much about it, but I remember the quality of the pictures, the way everything in them seemed to be coated with a mixture of sunlight and dust, and how dark the shadows were under people's eyebrows and along their cheekbones. The interviews with people still alive then were in color. The one I remember best was with a woman who had been the mistress of a man who had supervised one of the camps where they put the Jews before they killed them. In ovens, my mother said, But there weren't any pictures of the oven, so I got some confused notion that these deaths had taken place in kitchens. There is something especially terrifying to a child in that idea. Ovens mean cooking, and cooking comes before eating. I thought these people had been eaten, which, in a way, I suppose they had been. From what they said, the man had been cruel and brutal. The mistress, my mother explained mistress. She did not believe in mystification. I had a pop-up book of sexual organs by the time I was 4. The mistress had once been very beautiful. There was a black and white shot of her and another woman in two-piece bathing suits and platform shoes and picture hats of the time. They were wearing cat's-eye sunglasses and sitting in deck chairs by a swimming pool. The swimming pool was beside their house, which was near the camp with the ovens. The woman said she didn't notice much that she found unusual. She denied knowing about the ovens. At the time of the interview, 40 or 50 years later, she was dying of emphysema. She coughed a lot and she was very thin, almost emaciated, but she still took pride in her appearance. "Look at that," said my mother, half grudgingly, half admiringly. "She still takes pride in her appearance." She was carefully made up, heavy mascara on her eyelashes, rouge on the bones of her cheeks, over which the skin was stretched like a rubber glove pulled tight. She was wearing pearls. "He was not a monster," she said. "People say he was a monster, but he was not one." What could she have been thinking about? Not much, I guess. Not back then, not at the time. She was thinking about how not to think. The times were abnormal. She took pride in her appearance. She did not believe he was a monster. He was not a monster to her. Probably he had some endearing trait. He whistled off-key in the shower. He had a yen for truffles. He called his dog Liebchen and made it sit up for little pieces of raw steak. How easy it is to invent a humanity for anyone at all. What an available temptation. A big child, she would have said to herself. Her heart would have melted. She'd have smoothed the hair back from his forehead, kissed him on the ear, and not just to get something out of him either. The instinct to soothe, to make it better. "There, there," she'd say, as he woke from a nightmare. "Things are so hard for you." All this she would have believed, because otherwise how could she have kept on living? She was very ordinary under that beauty. She believed in decency. She was nice to the Jewish maid, or nice enough, nicer than she needed to be. Several days after this interview with her was filmed, she killed herself. It said that right on television. Nobody asked her whether or not she'd loved him. What I remember now, most of all, is the makeup. I stand up in the dark, start to unbutton. Then I hear something inside my body. I've broken. Something has cracked. That must be it. Noise is coming up, coming out of the broken place in my face. Without warning, I wasn't thinking about here or there or anything. If I let the noise get out into the air, it will be laughter. Too loud, too much of it. Someone is bound to hear, and then there will be hurrying footsteps and commands, and who knows? Judgment. Emotion inappropriate to the occasion. The wandering womb, they used to think. Hysteria. And then a needle, a pill. It could be fatal. I cram both hands over my mouth as if I'm about to be sick, drop to my knees, the laughter boiling up like lava in my throat. I crawl into the cupboard, draw up my knees. I'll choke on it. My ribs hurt with holding back. I shake. I heave. Seismic. Volcanic. I'll burst. Red all over the cupboard. Mirth rhymes with birth. Oh, to die of laughter. I stifle it in the folds of the hanging cloak. Clench my eyes from which tears are squeezing. Try to compose myself. After a while, it passes. like an epileptic fit. Here I am in the closet. Nolite, te bastardes, carborundorum. I can't see it in the dark, but I trace the tiny scratched writing with the ends of my fingers, as if it's a code in Braille. It sounds in my head now less like a prayer, more like a command. But to do what? Useless to me in any case, an ancient hieroglyphic to which the key's been lost. Why did she write it? Why did she bother? There's no way out of here. I lie on the floor, breathing too fast, then slower, evening out my breathing, as in the exercises for giving birth. All I can hear now is the sound of my own heart, opening and closing, opening and closing, opening. Soul Scrolls, 25. What I heard first the next morning was a scream and a crash. Cora dropping the breakfast tray. It woke me up. I was still half in the cupboard, head on the bundled cloak. I must have pulled it off the hanger and gone to sleep there. For a moment I couldn't remember where I was. Cora was kneeling beside me. I felt her hand touch my back. She screamed again when I moved. "What's wrong?" I said. I rolled over, pushed myself up. "Oh," she said. I thought... She thought what? "Like," she said. The eggs had broken on the floor. There was orange juice and shattered glass. "I'll have to bring another one," she said. "Such a waste." "What was you doing on the floor like that?" She was pulling at me to get me up respectably onto my feet. I didn't want to tell her I'd never been to bed at all. There would be no way of explaining that. I told her I must have fainted. That was almost as bad because she seized on it. "It's one of the early signs," she said, pleased. "That and throwing up." She should have known there hadn't been time enough, but she was very hopeful. "No, it's not that," I said. I was sitting in the chair. "I'm sure it isn't that. I was just dizzy. I was just standing there and things went dark." "It must have been the strain," she said, "of yesterday and all. Takes it out of you." She meant the birth, and I said it did. By this time I was sitting in the chair, and she was kneeling on the floor, picking up the pieces of broken glass and egg, gathering them onto the tray. She blotted some of the orange juice with the paper napkin. "I'll have to bring a cloth," she said. "They'll want to know why the extra eggs. Unless you could do without..." She looked at me sideways, slyly, and I saw that it would be better if we could both pretend I'd eaten my breakfast after all. If she said she'd found me lying on the floor, there would be too many questions. She'd have to account for the broken glass in any case, but Rita would get surly if she had to cook a second breakfast. "I'll do without," I said. "I'm not that hungry." This was good. It fit in with the dizziness. "But I could manage the toast," I said. I didn't want to go without breakfast altogether. "It's been on the floor," she said. "I don't mind," I said. I sat there eating the piece of brown toast while she went into the bathroom and flushed the handful of egg, which could not be salvaged, down the toilet. Then she came back. "I'll say I dropped the tray on the way out," she said. It pleased me that she was willing to lie for me, even in such a small thing, even for her own advantage. It was a link between us. I smiled at her. "I hope nobody heard you," I said. "It did give me a turn," she said, as she stood in the doorway with the tray. "At first I thought it was just your clothes, like. Then I said to myself, what are they doing there on the floor? I thought maybe you'd..." "Run off," I said. "Well, but," she said, "but it was you." "Yes," I said, "it was." "And it was." And she went out with the tray and came back with a cloth for the rest of the orange juice. And Rita that afternoon made a grumpy remark about some folks being all thumbs. "Too much on their minds. Don't look where they're going," she said, and we continued on from there as if nothing had happened. That was in May. Spring has now been undergone. The tulips have had their moment and are done shedding their petals one by one like teeth. One day I came upon Serena Joy, kneeling on a cushion in the garden, her cane beside her on the grass. She was snipping off the seed pods with a pair of shears. I watched her sideways as I went past with my basket of oranges and lamb chops. She was aiming, positioning the blades of the shears, then cutting with a convulsive jerk of the hands. Was it the arthritis creeping up? Or some blitzkrieg, some kamikaze committed on the swelling genitalia of the flowers, the fruiting body? To cut off the seed pods is supposed to make the bulb store energy. Saint Serena, on her knees, doing penance. I often amused myself this way with some small, mean-minded, bitter jokes about her, but not for long. It doesn't do to linger watching Serena Joy from behind. What I coveted was the shears. Well, then we had the irises, rising beautiful and cool on their tall stalks like blown glass, like pastel water momentarily frozen in a splash, light blue, light mauve, and the darker ones, velvet and purple, black cat's ears in the sun, indigo shadow, and the bleeding hearts, so female in shape it was a surprise they'd not long since been rooted out. There is something subversive about this garden of Serena's, a sense of buried things bursting upwards, wordlessly, into the light, as if to point, to say, whatever is silenced will clamor to be heard, though silently. A Tennyson garden, heavy with scent, languid. The return of the word swoon. Light pours down upon it from the sun, true, but also heat rises from the flowers themselves. You can feel it, like holding your hand an inch above an arm, a shoulder. It breathes in the warmth, breathing itself in. To walk through it in these days of peonies, of pinks and carnations, makes my head swim. The willow is in full plumage and is no help with its insinuating whispers. Rendezvous, it says. Terraces. The sibilants run up my spine, a shiver as if in fever. The summer dress rustles against the flesh of my thighs. The grass grows underfoot. At the edges of my eyes there are movements in the branches, feathers, flittings, grace notes, tree into bird, metamorphosis run wild. Goddesses are possible now, and the air suffuses with desire. Even the bricks of the house are softening, becoming tactile, as if I leaned against them they'd be warm and yielding. It's amazing what denial can do. Did the sight of my ankle make him lightheaded, faint, at the checkpoint yesterday when I dropped my pass and let him pick it up for me? No handkerchief, no fan, I use what's handy. Winter is not so dangerous. I need hardness, cold, rigidity, not this heaviness as if I'm a melon on a stem, this liquid ripeness. The commander and I have an arrangement. It's not the first such arrangement in history, though the shape it's taken is not the usual one. I visit the commander 2 or 3 nights a week, always after dinner, but only when I get the signal. The signal is Nick. If he's polishing the car when I set out for the shopping or when I come back, and if his hat is on askew or not on at all, then I go. If he isn't there, or if he has his hat on straight, then I stay in my room in the ordinary way. On ceremony nights, of course, none of this applies. The difficulty is the wife, as always. After dinner, she goes to their bedroom, from where she could conceivably hear me as I sneak along the hall, although I take care to be very quiet. Or she stays in the sitting room, knitting away at her endless angel scarves, turning out more and more yards of intricate and useless wool people. Her form of procreation, it must be. The sitting room door is usually left ajar when she's in there, and I don't dare go past it. When I've had the signal, but can't make it, down the stairs or along the hall, past the sitting room, the commander understands. He knows my situation. None better. He knows all the rules. Sometimes, however, Serena Joy is out visiting another commander's wife, a sick one. That's the only place she could conceivably go by herself in the evenings. She takes food, a cake, or pie, or loaf of bread baked by Rita, or a jar of jelly made from the mint leaves that grow in her garden. They get sick a lot, these wives of the commanders. It adds interest to their lives. As for us, the handmaids and even the Marthas, we avoid illness. The Marthas don't want to be forced to retire because who knows where they go. You don't see that many old women around anymore. And as for us, any real illness, anything lingering, weakening, a loss of flesh or appetite, a fall of hair, a failure of the glands would be terminal. I remember Cora, earlier in the spring, staggering around even though she had the flu, holding on to the door frames when she thought no one was looking, being careful not to cough. A slight cold, she said, when Serena asked her. Serena herself sometimes takes a few days off, tucked up in bed. Then she's the one to get the company. The wives rustling up the stairs, clucking and cheerful, she gets the cakes and pies, the jelly, the bouquets of flowers from their gardens. They take turns. There must be some sort of list, invisible, unspoken. Each is careful not to hog more than her share of the attention. On the nights when Serena is due to be out, I'm sure to be summoned. The first time I was confused. His needs were obscure to me, and what I could perceive of them seemed to me ridiculous, laughable, like a fetish for lace-up shoes. Also, there had been a letdown of sorts. What had I been expecting behind that closed door the first time? Something unspeakable, down on all fours, perhaps? Perversions, whips, mutilations? At the very least, some minor sexual manipulation, some bygone peccadillo now denied him, prohibited by law and punishable by amputation. To be asked to play Scrabble instead, as if we were an old married couple or two children, seemed kinky in the extreme, a violation in its own way. As a request, it was opaque. So when I left the room, it still wasn't clear to me what he wanted, or why, or whether I could fulfill any of it for him. If there's to be a bargain, the terms of exchange must be set forth. This was something he certainly had not done. I thought he might be toying some cat-and-mouse routine, but now I think that his motives and desires weren't obvious, even to him. They had not yet reached the level of words. The second evening began in the same way as the first. I went to the door, which was closed, knocked on it, was told to come in. Then followed the same two games with the smooth beige counters. Prolix, quartz, quandary, sylph, rhythm, all the old tricks with consonants I could dream up or remember. My tongue felt thick with the effort of spelling. It was like using a language I'd once known but had nearly forgotten, a language having to do with customs that had long before passed out of the world. Café au lait on an outdoor table, with a brioche, absinthe in a tall glass, or shrimp in a cornucopia of newspaper, things I'd read about once but had never seen. It was like trying to walk without crutches, like those phony scenes in old TV movies. You can do it. I know you can. That was the way my mind lurched and stumbled among the sharp R's and T's, sliding over the ovoid vowels as if on pebbles. The commander was patient when I hesitated or asked him for a correct spelling. We can always look it up in the dictionary, he said. He said, we. The first time, I realized he'd let me win. That night I was expecting everything to be the same, including the goodnight kiss. But when we'd finished the second game, he sat back in his chair. He placed his elbows on the arms of the chair, the tips of his fingers together, and looked at me. "I have a little present for you," he said. He smiled a little. Then he pulled open the top drawer of his desk and took something out. He held it a moment, casually enough, between thumb and finger, as if deciding whether or not to give it to me. Although it was upside down from where I was sitting, I recognized it. They were once common enough. It was a magazine. A woman's magazine, it looked like from the picture, a model on glossy paper, hair blown, neck scarved, mouth lipsticked, the fall fashions. I thought such magazines had all been destroyed, but here was one, left over in the commander's private study, where you'd least expect to find such a thing. He looked down at the model, who was right side up to him. He was still smiling, that wistful smile of his. It was a look you'd give to an almost extinct animal at the zoo. Staring at the magazine, as he dangled it before me like fish bait, I wanted it. I wanted it with a force that made the ends of my fingers ache. At the same time, I saw this longing of mine as trivial and absurd, because I'd taken such magazines lightly enough once. I'd read them in dentists' offices and sometimes on planes. I'd bought them to take to hotel rooms, a device to fill in empty time while I was waiting for Luke. After I'd leafed through them, I would throw them away, for they were infinitely discardable. And a day or two later, I wouldn't be able to remember what had been in them. Though I remembered now. What was in them was promise. They dealt in transformations. They suggested an endless series of possibilities, extending like the reflections in two mirrors set facing one another, stretching on, replica after replica, to the vanishing point. They suggested one adventure after another, one wardrobe after another, one improvement after another, one man after another. They suggested rejuvenation, pain overcome and transcended, endless love. The real promise in them was immortality. This was what he was holding without knowing it. He riffled the pages. I felt myself leaning forward. "It's an old one," he said, "a curio of sorts. From the 70s, I think. A Vogue." This like a wine connoisseur dropping a name. "I thought you might like to look at it." I hung back. He might be testing me to see how deep my indoctrination had really gone. "It's not permitted," I said. "In here it is," he said quietly. I saw the point. Having broken the main taboo, why should I hesitate over another one, something minor? Or another? Who could tell where it might stop? Behind this particular door, taboo dissolved. I took the magazine from him and turned it the right way round. There they were again, the images of my childhood, bold, striding, confident, their arms flung out as if to claim space, their legs apart, feet planted squarely on the earth. There was something Renaissance about the pose, but it was princes I thought of, not coiffed and ringleted maidens. Those candid eyes, shadowed with makeup, yes, but like the eyes of cats, fixed for the pounce. No quailing, no clinging there, not in those capes and rough tweeds, those boots that came to the knee. Pirates, these women, with their ladylike briefcases for the loot and their horsey acquisitive teeth. I felt the commander watching me as I turned the pages. I knew I was doing something I shouldn't have been doing, and that he found pleasure in seeing me do it. I should have felt evil. By Aunt Lydia's lights, I was evil, but I didn't feel evil. Instead, I felt like an old Edwardian seaside postcard. Naughty. What was he going to give me next? A girdle? Why do you have this? I asked him. Some of us, he said, retain an appreciation for the old things. But these were supposed to have been burned, I said. There were house-to-house searches, bonfires. What's dangerous in the hands of the multitudes, he said, with what may or may not have been irony, is safe enough for those whose motives are beyond reproach, I said. He nodded gravely. Impossible to tell whether or not he meant it. But why show it to me? I said, and then felt stupid. What could he possibly say? That he was amusing himself at my expense? For he must have known how painful it was to me to be reminded of the former time. I wasn't prepared for what he actually did say. Who else could I show it to? He said. And there it was again. That sadness. Should I go further, I thought. I didn't want to push him too far, too fast. I knew I was dispensable. Nevertheless, I said too softly, how about your wife? He seemed to think about that. No, he said, she wouldn't understand. Anyway, she won't talk to me much anymore. We don't seem to have much in common these days. So there it was, out in the open. His wife didn't understand him. That's what I was there for, then. The same old thing. It was too banal to be true.
This ends side two of cassette four. Please stop the tape before fast-forwarding to the end and loading cassette five.